Our guest today is Neil Jackson, a senior lecturer in film and TV at the University of Lincoln, who is currently in the middle of writing a book for Bloomsbury's Global Exploitation Cinema series on the topic of what he calls NAMSploitation, exploitation films that deal with the topic of the Vietnam War called Combat Shocks. Neil, thanks very much for agreeing to talk to me about your new upcoming book. How do you distinguish NAMSploitation films from other Hollywood depictions of Vietnam? Because I would think that responding to recent or topical events means that even some of those Hollywood depictions of Vietnam, like the Deer Hunter, are in a way NAMSploitation. Would I be right in thinking that, or is there a better way that you delineate between?
No, I would tend to agree with you, because one of the points that I try to make from the outset of the book is that when we're talking about the differentiation between so-called exploitation cinema and the mainstream of Hollywood, or the mainstream of any film culture, is that it's just as interesting to talk about the points of crossover as it is the points of difference and departure. So in response to your question, I would say the best way in order to think about the essential differences between this thing we're calling NAMSploitation and the Hollywood Vietnam film, as we've come to understand it through films such as The Deer Hunter and Apocalypse Now and Platoon and Full Metal Jacket, and of course before that the much maligned John Wayne effort, The Green Berets, and all of those other big Hollywood films which had a lot of money behind them. Brian De Palma's Casualties of War as well, I always think is one of the more interesting examples. Yeah, the chief way to distinguish between Hollywood and the exploitation sector is to think about the levels of economic disparity, the levels of resources that are available to a Hollywood studio. Sometimes exploitation films can do very, very interesting things with very, very little at their disposal. And that can be anything from telling stories or creating ideas on a very, very small scale, but very, very effectively. And one of the ways I've tried to structure the book is to emphasize early on that many of the tropes and the conventions and the recurring themes that we take for granted as being part of that Hollywood mainstream development as far as Vietnam War cinema is concerned, many of those things were already in place in some of these lower budgeted productions that were emerging as early as the mid-1960s. Okay, it seems strange to think now that there are already Vietnam War films being made in the mid-1960s. But yeah, I think chiefly it's just to reiterate that point, it's much more interesting to think, or just as interesting to think about those points of crossover, those points of convergence, rather than the points of difference when it comes to these things. Because it's only that way that we will get a much fuller, a much more rounded picture of what Vietnam War cinema actually is. Now, we tend to think of Vietnam War cinema as a kind of history of kings. We think of that traumatic production of Apocalypse Now, when everything went wrong. We think about these great auteur figures like Coppola and Cimino and Oliver Stone and Stanley Kubrick and Brian De Palma, all making these great auteur visions. Yes, they are the things that get out there. They are the things that reach audiences. But very often, I think some of the more interesting and, to use a word, quirky representations of the Vietnam War itself came out of the independent and exploitation sectors, not just in exploitation films, but also in the form of documentaries and short films and so on and so on.
So what would you say are the chief characteristics then of NAMSploitation in terms of the kind of on-screen characteristics and maybe the industrial characteristics? You mentioned a little bit about the budget, but are there anything others that surround these what you would describe as NAMSploitation?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of characteristics, I think a chief thing to remember is that, again, some of those early films, and by early films, I'm referring to films with titles like A Yank in Vietnam, which seems to be a lost film now, to the Shores of Hell, The Losers, Captain Milkshake, all films which, are relatively little seen. the conventions of those films are very much coming out of a genre which had been which had been developing certainly out of World War II. So all of those conventions, for example, of the World War II combat film, we can see these new Vietnam war films struggling with how to adopt those conventions into a new type of conflict. Right. So the conflict in World War II was very clear cut, or so it seemed. You know, we had this fascist leader who was intent on world domination, and it was the job of the USA and the Allied forces to, you know, to actually stop this individual and his Third Reich. Of course, that also applies to America's fight with Japan as well. That's how it's perceived from, you know, from an American perspective. So yeah, so those conventions, those war film, and particularly those combat film conventions, start to take on new types of meanings, new shapes, new interesting variations when we see the Vietnam War film developing. So we can see how that there was a much greater degree of cynicism in some films about the place of the combat soldier in the war zone, in the theater of war itself. There is a much greater questioning of what you would call American ideological imperatives. And that questioning is that kind of differs from film to film. So the first two films that I referred to some moments ago, To the Shores of Hell and A Yank in Vietnam, they were very much gung-ho right-wing films, very much precursors to what John Wayne did on a much bigger budget in The Green Berets. However, Captain Milkshake and The Losers are both films which are coming out of the counterculture. Okay, so in the case of Captain Milkshake, it's a film which actually shoots some footage up at Berkeley University during a protest. It actually captures some of that footage, and it's about this soldier who is coming home on leave to attend a funeral of one of his relatives. And while he's home on leave from Vietnam, he gets mixed up with the counterculture, and he starts to doubt his motivations for serving in Vietnam. Previously, he'd been very, again, very patriotic, very gung-ho about his presence there. In The Losers, that's a film which merges the conventions of the biker film as it had developed up to that point. So it's a film coming out of that whole biker film cycle, you know, if you'll pardon the awful pun. And of course, which had been heavily popularized and mainstreamed in the form of Easy Rider just a year before in 1969. So yeah, that's that The Losers is combining those conventions. And it's a film which actually puts a gang of bikers in the middle of Vietnam. You know, the conventions on the one hand are being adhered to in some of those earlier films, but by the end of the 1960s, we can see how the conventions are also kind of being twisted and bent out of shape because of this infiltration of all kinds of countercultural sensibilities. By the time we get to the new flowering of the so-called Namsploitation cycle in the 1980s, I think there is a great tendency again, not so much to create new types of conventions, but to there's much more a case of responding to the big Vietnam hits of the time. So, for example, when First Blood and Rambo, it's the First Blood sequel, when they come out, of course, there's a whole rash of imitators, not just in America, but in places like Italy as well. So the conventions then become much more a case of, right, this is what happened in the large-scale Hollywood model. What can we do on our reduced budget? So you start to see the canon Namsploitation films as well. You know, the Chuck Norris productions, the film with Michael Dudikoff called Platoon Leader, for example. So the conventions again are starting to become, or at least the deployment of the conventions is becoming much more self-conscious. It's becoming almost self-reflexive in some cases. And I think a film like The Exterminator, which appeared in 1980 initially, that is a kind of a turning point, because that whole opening sequence of The Exterminator, that is something which kind of condenses many of the combat film elements, which were so intrinsic to the war film up to that point, and to the Vietnam War film as well. It's almost like a 7-minute condensing of everything that had been in place in depictions of combat in Vietnam up to that point. Yeah, so the conventions themselves are difficult to define as being purely a phenomenon of the exploitation sector. Again, as I stressed from the outset, these conventions are very much in place in other mainstream films as well. It's just that the points of variation, the points of departure, when they do occur, are very, very interesting. And it's those films which do that, I think, in the most interesting way that I've tried to focus upon in the book.
I've got a question that I was going to ask a little bit later because it's quite specific. But since it's coming from that, I wonder whether there's, I mean, tell me if I'm wrong, but there's a sort of trope that develops around the Vietnam films of the psychotic veteran returning back to the US from Vietnam. And we know this from a number of different films. The Exterminator is one of them, or at the very least, he's made psychotic through events that happen in the streets of New York, Taxi Driver, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I wonder, the question I had was that psychotic veteran returning, has that been a trope at all for any other type of war films? Or is it specifically the Vietnam movies that bring that trope into public
So
consciousness?
certainly there are instances in which the veteran is depicted as being to coin an old phrase, shell-shocked, what we would now call PTSD, of course. But I think certainly that idea of the psychotic veteran is very much a symptom of the divisiveness of the war itself. This sense that the nation divided as it became can be embodied through the individual. And of course, that divisiveness manifests itself in a kind of psychosis. I mean, lest we forget, many of those psychotic Vietnam veteran on the loose movies were ripping off films like Death Wish. And of course, it's that they make a point in Death Wish of stressing that the Charles Bronson character, Paul Kersey, is actually a Korean veteran. There are precedents for this idea of the war veteran who is disturbed, who is who I think another key precursor is the Peter Bogdanovich film Targets, of course, where it is very, very subtly indicated that this character, this sniper, is also a Vietnam War veteran. Yeah, so this idea of soldiers coming out of a war and not necessarily adjusting very well to their environment back in the USA is something which certainly manifests most explicitly in the Vietnam War film cycle itself. I mean, one of the earliest and I still think most interesting examples of it being depicted explicitly in all kinds of ways is Forced Entry, the hardcore porn film from 1972. In which it utilizes newsreel footage of Vietnam with the various sexually violent activities of the central character in that film. So it's a film which is very, very explicitly linking his own psychosis, his own perversions, with his experiences in Vietnam. It just so happens that the film juxtaposes that footage of real life war atrocities with hardcore sex scenes involving rape. So it's a very, very disturbing melange. It's a film, certainly which it probably isn't going to be for most people. And it's a film which at the same time I think is kind of quite bold in this perverse way in terms of way it's positioning itself amidst the whole disturbance that had been engendered by the Vietnam experience. Yeah, so as the decade progresses after that, we see all of these different manifestations. You've already come up with one or two titles. Another great example, of course, is the Rolling Thunder, which was another example of a veteran who comes back after a long and traumatic period of captivity, and his family, soon after his return to the US, his family is brutally murdered. He's left for dead. It's almost like he's this avenging ghost for the rest of the film, completely shorn of any kind of moral judgment and fortitude, as it were. And he spends the rest of the film pursuing the people responsible for that. And another great example, Black Sunday, in which Bruce Dern plays this terrorist on American soil. He's a white American terrorist who's also a Vietnam veteran who is Again, enacting his own revenge for what he sees as his betrayal by the US government. And he does that in the form of this climactic sequence in which he tries to blow up an entire football stadium in this airship. Yeah, so the idea of the dangerous, the unhinged, the loose cannon Vietnam veteran, of course, soon became cliche. And it became a kind of one-stop excuse for all kinds of violent behavior by these disturbed young characters in all kinds of films. These types of, you know, these types of representations, when they're done so often, they soon become kind of tiresome and roll over into the realms of cliche very, very quickly.
As you say, the Exterminator is maybe a kind of key film for some of the things that you're discussing, because as you've mentioned, not only does it cement some of these tropes, but it also comes at that hinge point between the 70s and the 1980s, right? So it's 1980, I think, that it came out. And it's also got that moment where he kind of comes back home, and but you've also got this extended sequence at the start that actually takes place in Vietnam, with a lot of those other films where you've got the psychotic character coming home. We don't actually get to see. We don't see John Rambo in Vietnam until he goes back there and he's dropped there in the sequel to rescue the POWs. I mean, again, I'm going into specifics when I want to talk about some of the general stuff, but it's the right time to talk about The Exterminator, I think. Can you talk me through what's so fascinating about that opening sequence of The Exterminator that happens before the opening credits?
Yeah, I mean, from a production context, I think it's always interesting to point out this. I mean, this has been pointed out before, but it's... the sequence itself was shot at the back end of production. They'd already started to edit the film when it was decided that they had something substantial enough here to pour a bit more money into. And while they'd made a point in the film as it was originally shot and written, while they'd made a point of stressing that the character was a Vietnam veteran, that the decision was made to actually depict that character in Vietnam. So what you have is a film that cost about $850,000, I think, also suddenly becomes a much more expensive film because of this 1 7-minute sequence, which opens the film. And it's something which, as I said earlier, it's something which condenses so much of what had been visible and controversial in Vietnam War films up to that point. So, for example, you've got this nocturnal setting. And it's very reminiscent of that sequence in Apocalypse Now, set at the Dolan Bridge, that bridge which is constantly being rebuilt and destroyed again. So that nocturnal setting and all these kind of quasi-psychedelic lighting effects, although done a lot less elaborately in The Exterminator than in Apocalypse Now. You've also got this idea of American soldiers in captivity, under duress, being tortured, which of course has been lifted directly from The Deer Hunter. So it's drawing upon what had been much talked about elements or very striking elements of big Vietnam hits of that time, but condensing them into this one sequence. Also, I think from a production point of view, the fact that the sequence was also shot out in California, you know, that the Exterminator itself was very much a New York production. You know, Glickenhaus and James Glickenhaus, the director, and Mark Buntzman, the producer, all friends from the New York area, going right back to childhood. And all of the money for the film came out of New York. They went out to this place called Indian Dunes in California to shoot this sequence over about 4 days. So Indian Dunes was this kind of ranch land which had been used by all kinds of TV shows, and I think it was used a lot for westerns and so on and so on. And they spend all this money on this sequence, and there are reports starting to leak through into some of the trade press at the time that there are one or two health and safety issues as far as the shooting of this sequence are concerned. And ironically enough, just a couple of years later, Indian Dunes was the place where the infamous Twilight Zone accident occurred. Okay. So as both a sequence unto itself and as the story underpinning how the sequence came into being, where it was shot, how it was shot, and how it adds at this tremendous level of production value to the film. It makes the film immediately look like an expensive production. The rest of the film is shot in a relatively modest style. You know, you get lots of interesting location footage of New York, but the rest of the film is never so elaborate in terms of its visual construction, in terms of the spectacle. Yes, there are some stunts and yes, there are some explosions and so on, but none of it is as elaborate as what is poured into that opening sequence. And I think certainly as far as being a key marker as to what would occur in the Vietnam War film over the rest of the decade, over the rest of the 1980s, it is absolutely essential because it is essentially signposting what would already been apparent in one or two other films earlier, but it is essentially signposting that the Vietnam War film, by and large, would become another outgrowth of the action adventure branch of the war film, because most of the Vietnam War films that were produced in the 1980s were of the action adventure variety. They weren't dealing with politics. They weren't dealing with the ethical or the moral dimensions of the war. And if they were doing that, they were doing it in very superficial ways. So it is a really interesting sequence, but I think it's a key and important sequence in its own way as well, as far as the development of a Vietnam War film is concerned.
What about the and obviously we want to talk about other films as well, but I really like that sequence. Can you tell me something about the kind of brutality of it in terms of the way it positions the lead character? Because it's quite interesting to see him being in a kind of very vulnerable position at that point, right? And he doesn't deal with it particularly stoically either. Yeah. And it's got that extraordinary decapitation moment as well. So just tell me a little bit about the kind of brutality of that sequence and its importance to the rest of the film, and maybe how that relates to the rest of the cycle of Nam's exploitation.
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of setting up the central character himself, you know, played by Robert Ginty, it's important in terms of emphasizing his essential weakness and passivity, because it's the first of two occasions in the film in which he is rescued and saved by his friend, played by Steve James, who, of course, is very soon becomes the victim of the crime, which leads to Ginty's vigilante spree. So, in terms of setting up the character and the methods that he deploys during his revenge spree, I think it's really important. Yeah, I mean, in terms of the brutality of the sequence, it is obviously indulging itself in all kinds of ways. Again, I've read an interview somewhere with Glickenhaus, or maybe it was Buntzman, I can't remember, but they stressed that when they sat down to actually write the script for this, they had a series of action or violent set pieces around which they constructed a very, very simple narrative. And let's face it, it's not the most sophisticated film in terms of its narrative development, although it does have this really interesting touch where we get these ellipses, these sudden jump cuts or jump fades to much later in the narrative development. But yeah, I mean, the brutality of the sequence itself, I think, again, is essential in terms of positioning itself within the exploitation market. Okay, it's not only emphasizing the spectacle of explosions and the use of helicopters and you know this really impressive kind of outdoor production design that they managed to pull off, but the litany of the bullet riddled bodies and slashed throats and of course the infamous decapitation which was created by Stan Winston relatively early in his filmmaking career. Apparently that decapitated head effect alone cost about $25,000 to pull off. So all of those elements, you know, the explicit depiction of violence in that sequence is an indulgence. Okay, I don't think it in any way it can justify itself in terms of having any kind of thing of import or consequence to say about what occurred in that war, besides something we already know, that is that people died in all kinds of horrible ways on both sides. And indeed, it sets up this level of sadism which the character exhibits for the rest of the film. The protagonist himself, he doesn't just kill his victims, he kills them in often painful and excruciating ways. We see one mobster, of course, lowered slowly into a meat mincer. We see another paedophile pimp slowly burning to death. So all of those kind of, again, it sounds slightly pretentious, but the kind of the image system of that early sequence, of that opening sequence in the film, sets up many of the atrocities that are committed by the character himself. And I suppose, again, it kind of justifies the sense that this is also somebody suffering from a form of PTSD. There are a couple of moments in the film where he has these brief flashbacks, these brief memory flashbacks to Vietnam. So yes, it's an indulgence. Yes, it is satisfying the demands of the exploitation market, but at the same time, it does at least also set up something about this character and how he commits the acts that he commits later in the film.
Yeah, for me, it just completely grips you, and it puts you in a completely different kind of psychological space in relation to that film, right? Because it means everything else is coloured by his experiences there, and it's not just this one moment that sets him off. The John Eastland character, the main character played by Robert Ginty, it's got the grip of this opening sequence for me is there throughout the rest of the film. Well, and it means that those, as you say, those weird ellipses in time, when you're not quite sure whether that's Glickenhaus's inexperience in putting a narrative film together or whether it's intentionally they're just skipping over time.
Absolutely.
It gives it almost like, I don't question it because of that fantastic opening scene.
I think, I first encountered the film on home video in, I think it was probably about 1982 in this country, on the Alpha Intervision label. And of course, the version we were seeing in the UK at that point in time was a fairly heavily cut version. And the film would continue to be cut right into the late 90s, early noughties, until we finally got the uncut version. But yeah, that version that I saw removed many of the aforementioned violent detail from that opening sequence. It also removed various pieces of material from later in the film, particularly that sequence set in the brothel, the so-called chicken hawk ranch. Okay, so that sense of it being something that was extremes, something that was experiencing at that point in time as a young viewer, I really did get a sense that I was watching a new kind of action adventure thriller. Okay, because I'd never seen violence quite like that on the screen. And I think that was something that Glickenhaus did in his next film as well, The Soldier, which was called the codename The Soldier over here, where he tried to do something similar with the spy movie. It was obviously riffing upon the James Bond series. But as far as I'm concerned, it's a much more interesting film, again, in terms of its style, in terms of its narrative oddness, in terms of its soundtrack by Tangerine Dream. It's a much more interesting film than what was happening in the James Bond, Roger Moore era at that point in time, For Your Eyes Only and Octopussy. Give me The Soldier any day of the week over those.
Yeah, we'll have to agree to disagree on that one, Neil, but we'll skip over that. Let's move on to think about what some of the other key films are in your study. Now, I know there's going to be a section of American films that you would term namsploitation, but I imagine, in fact, I'm pretty certain there'll be a whole host of non-US originated films that form part of this study. Can you just tell me give me some of the titles from the American films and I imagine Italian films
are part. Yeah, well, just going back to the beginning again, there's four or five films in particular that I've talked about. There is To the Shores of Hell, which is a film which features an actor called Marshall Thompson, who is in very ways much the original precursor to what we would eventually see emerge in the 1980s, this kind of gung-ho American action hero. Okay. There is Captain Milkshake, The Losers, and a film which has barely ever been released anywhere called A Torn Page of Glory, which is from a bit later, and it's very difficult to date. Nobody seems to know exactly when it was made. It's got a small role for Aldo Ray. Yeah. And from his appearance, I would say it's quite possibly made somewhere between the mid to late 70s, possibly even after The Deer Hunter. And so those four films are films which I'm trying to make a case for as having established a whole range of themes and ideas and conventions, apart from the developments of what we would now consider to be the mainstream of the Vietnam War film cycle. Also, of course, The Exterminator. I'm very much interested in that opening sequence. Forced Entry, I've got an extended section on that, which is developing out of a piece which I've already published. There is also going to be a section about certain elements of the film, which has more or less given the book its title, Combat Shock. The title of the book would be Combat Shocks, plural. But Combat Shock itself is a film which is, again, very much predicated upon this notion of the returning veteran about his PTSD. But it's a film which, again, is very, very conscious. You would say very self-conscious about the conventions of the form, which had developed up to the point of its production and its release in the mid-1980s. It is not only drawing upon the idea of the war veteran, the returning war veteran, and this kind of revenge narrative, but it's also referencing things like Eraserhead and so on. Okay, yes, I'm going to be saying something about that. As far as the European variations are concerned, I'm very much interested in talking about two films directed by Antonio Margheriti under his Anthony M. Dawson moniker. The first of which is the Last Hunter, that was its common English title, and the other one is Cannibal Apocalypse, as it was known in the UK. Two films which kind of deal with different aspects of of the genre itself. These are films that almost, well, certainly The Last Hunter, again, is almost like an extension of The Exterminator in the way in which it is almost about the genre itself. But because it's coming from that much greater, that much greater distance from the American films, again, it can bring an entirely different flavor, an entirely different ambience and set of ideas to the Vietnam War film at that point in time. And it's also got one of the best twist endings I've ever seen. I won't give anything away, but it's got one of the best twist endings I've seen in any film, completely out of left field. Really, really takes you surprise because you're not used to twist endings in war films. But this is great. Yeah, so is that when I get to the latter sections of the book, I'm less interested in critical accounts of the films themselves because they have slipped so far into formula. I'm more interested in thinking about the ways in which the films were marketed as products within various certainly home video markets. So there's going to be more in the way of thinking about the ways in which the missing in action films and various Rambo ripoff films and so on and so on, the ways in which they utilize the iconography of the Vietnam War film up to that point, the ways in which they combine the elements of this kind of macho posturing in the images of some of the lead performers that we see in those posters and those video jacket designs and so on. Yeah, so I'm very much more interested in the latter sections of the book. I'm very much more interested in the Vietnam War film cycle as a marketing construct, as opposed to because otherwise there would just be too many films to talk about because the subgenre reaches a saturation point, and you can only extract so much to talk about in detail. So I thought it would be much more manageable to talk about those 80s films, that action adventure strain that I was referring to earlier. It would be much more interesting not to try and come up with a definitive list of all of the conventions and variations, but to look at how certain examples of those films actually functioned as these promotional ideas almost, which just happened to have a film attached to them as well.
Does the iconography of the way the films are marketed change over time? I mean, I imagine it does. I mean, obviously it does. But what is the distinction between those 60s and 70s films and then the 80s films? What What particular specific elements do we see?
Certainly, if you look at the posters for things like A Yank in Vietnam and To the Shores of Hell, they are very much mired in the conventions of the war film up to that point, the ways in which it was marketed, the ways in which the essential iconography of men in combat is absolutely central to the ways in which those films are marketed. By the time you get to those 80s examples, there is a much greater emphasis upon the relationship between individual male figures and items of weaponry. Okay, so if you wanted to get all psychoanalytic about it, you could talk about the phallic charge of military weaponry, whether it's whether it's huge automatic rifles, whether it's certain types of machine gun, whether it's knives, crossbows, all kinds of interesting kind of variations in the ways in which star images, or perhaps not so star images, are being utilized in relation to images of weaponry. Okay. Along the way, between those early examples and the 80s examples, of course, you see in the example of The Losers from 1970, that is very much playing more upon its status as a biker film. It's that the war, and it is also aligning itself much more closely to a film like The Dirty Dozen. So it's this idea of a men on a mission narrative. Okay, so it's drawing very much upon the cynicism of a film like The Dirty Dozen and absorbing that into its own marketing strategy. Although, having said that, again, The Losers is in itself a very cynical film. Famously, a film like The Exterminator again uses this image of the faceless vigilante with the flamethrower. Before that, I've mentioned Forced Entry earlier, although it wasn't a widely seen film, of course. The poster for that, which is out there, if you look online, you can find it. The poster for that stresses how the protagonist, the military taught him to kill in Vietnam, but that rape was his own idea. Okay. So he makes that distinction between what the military told him to do and his own, the way in which he carried that forward in order to enact his own psychosis and perversions. Yeah. So the various ways in which Vietnam is utilized into the marketing of these films. And certainly, again, I think by the time you get to the 1980s, many of the less scrupulous distributors, they're far less self-conscious in terms of exploiting, for lack of a better term again, in terms of exploiting the iconography. They are far less self-conscious. They are quite happy to splash images of helicopters, images of explosions, images of jungle landscapes and foliage and so on, regardless of the fact that the actual films that you see might not necessarily conform very, very accurately to the images that we see in the marketing materials. So you get that great disjuncture, I suppose, in many examples of the way in which we experience the film as a marketing construct and the actual relation at the actual experience of seeing the film itself on screen, which often cannot live up to the marketing image.
One of the things that you mentioned in one of the articles that you wrote was this recurring image of the person putting the gun, the American soldier putting a gun to their own head, which I guess originates in The Deer Hunter, I would imagine, from that famous sequence when they're forced to play Russian roulette. But can you tell me about variations of that? That, and I guess this is bringing us back to this idea of PTSD maybe as well, and this idea of the traumatized veteran and the tortured veteran. Can you tell me what place that image plays in Vietnam cinema?
Yeah, well, again, there is an example of that in Forced Entry. The film opens on the image of the lead character or the central character's opened skull. He shot himself. So we're aware of the fact from the beginning of the film that he has killed himself using a gun. But Films like Taxi Driver, of course, precede The Deer Hunter. There's that famous image of De Niro at the end of that film's climactic bloodbath, putting his finger to his head, his bloodied finger, and affecting the, you know, the motion of a pistol as he makes those sounds. We see it in things like Combat Shock. You know, spoilers ahoy here, sorry people, but the climax of that film finishes again in the climax of that film results in the protagonist, after having killed his entire family and all of the people who have been oppressing him right throughout the film, putting a gun to his head and blowing his own brains out. And of course, it also is very visible in those big popular action adventure films of the period as well. I think the most famous image in that regard is Mel Gibson putting a gun to his forehead in the opening sequences of Lethal Weapon. Now, so it's this idea, again, of the veteran as somebody who is very, very disturbed and taking the weight of responsibility and guilt and trauma upon themselves, and it manifesting in this, you know, in this desire just not to go on anymore, and just to end it all with the, you know, through the simple expediency of a bullet to the brain. And of course, a bullet in the head did in fact become the title of John Woo's Vietnam film, and became a central kind of metaphor and image in that as well.
So I've got two kind of areas of questions I want to ask you, and it's about specific, one's about a specific film, the other's about a range of films and how they relate. So let's deal with a specific film first, because you've already mentioned it, Cannibal Apocalypse, the Antonio Margheriti film. Now, how does that fit in, given the fact it does this kind of cannibal horror film narrative that it's got going on? Explain how that works and how that fits in.
I think the way in which it fits in to the kind of things I've been talking about so far is this idea of bringing back Vietnam as a form of contagion. Okay, the sickness of Vietnam coming back to America and contaminating this community that is depicted in the film. So, as a cannibal film, you know, we tend to think of those Italian cannibal films as things which went out into went out on location in South America, various tropical parts of that particular continent, depicted the lifestyles and the peculiarities of various tribal communities. And what Cannibal Apocalypse does is something quite different. The cannibals themselves are Americans, okay, and their cannibalism is seen to be something that came about as the result of chemicals that were utilized by American forces when they were in combat in Vietnam. So it's almost like the sins of America coming home revisit the domestic sphere. And it's this kind of ultimate taboo of cannibalism itself. You know, America is, and this is one of the things that I think that, because it's an Italian film, again, because it's becoming from a much further away than those American examples, it can play with those kinds of ideas. It can depict these disturbed veterans as these kind of blood-hungry, ravenous creatures that they become. That isn't necessarily something that a American filmmaker would have been in a hurry to depict if I wanted to sell the film within the American market. Although, having said that, of course, the film was quite widely distributed in America under a different title. I think it was Cannibals in the Streets or something like that. Yeah.
So it takes away that the apocalypse element of it, which may have linked people back to thinking it would, you know.
Yeah. I mean, of course, the inclusion of apocalypse in the title is pure Italian exploitation hucksterism, or at least hucksterism on the part of whoever was distributing the film in that particular territory. That's how we got it in the UK when it was released on video. Of course, it never had a theatrical release in this country. And under that title, it soon became embroiled in the video Nasties debacle of the early 80s as well.
And it's also got a sequence at the start set in Vietnam as well.
Yeah. It's this idea of Vietnam as prologue. So I don't know whether or not they thought, well, it worked for the exterminator, so it'll probably work for us as well. But it's nowhere near as elaborate a sequence. It's very obviously not shot in in the same kind of location. It's much smaller in scale. It's and it utilizes stock footage of helicopters and so on and so on. So it's obviously it's a much cheaper film all round than something like The Exterminator. But yeah, that idea of Vietnam as prologue is something which is another one of the great narrative conventions. Many of those many of those returning veteran narratives would have a prologue. Certainly it's a feature of one or two blaxploitation films in which many of the protagonists of those films were Vietnam veterans. Jim Brown in Slaughter, for example. We will often either hear from the characters themselves, or there will be a sequence at the beginning of the film which sets these characters up as veterans. And of course, in the case of those blaxploitation heroes, it just gives an extra kind of dimension to their anti-authoritarian, kind of anti-hero status as well.
So the next kind of narrative convention that comes up is this idea of returning back to Vietnam after the war to rescue captured POWs who are still being held captive. And First Blood Part Two, Missing in Action, Uncommon Valor, I think is another one you may know of some more. Can you tell me a little bit about how that convention fits in?
Well, I think a lot of it came out of reports that there may well indeed be people still in captivity in Vietnam. Now, as far as it becoming a convention of of these types of films, I'm not quite I'm not quite sure how the whole rescue element began. In fact, I think it may well be the case that something like The Losers, again going back to 1970, might be one of the first examples, because it's not so much a case of going back after the war is finished, because that was a film that was made when the film when the war was still in progress. But both that and To the Shores of Hell, those are both films in which Americans in captivity are rescued by are rescued by American either soldiers or, in the case of The Losers, this biker gang. So that idea of Americans in captivity was already in place as far as some of the films were concerned. But this idea of going back to Vietnam very much ties in, I think, to this desire to refight the war. If we go back to Vietnam, that will give us the opportunity to once again demonstrate our military superiority. And because we're doing these things covertly, it's something that we can do without recourse to any kind of institutional, authority or permission. And of course, the whole of the 1980s was a time in which covert military activity, covert intelligence was very much an issue as far as Reagan's adventures in Central America were concerned and in Latin America. So that idea of covertly going back and rescuing and kind of clawing something back from a war that had been very costly, very divisive, but also, very, 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 very troubling in terms of affecting America's own sense of its imperialist self, as it were. All of those things could be addressed because those missions are happening in secret. They're happening undercover. They're happening outside of the realms of conventional warfare.
Thanks. I've got two questions now, just that might be a good place to finish up, or they might be a complete dead end as well. That's the other possibility. But the first thing is how many films are you talking about here in terms of, do you get a sense of the numbers of films that were made that you could call namsploitation? When did they sort of peter out? And have there been any recent examples that you could pinpoint?
Depending on how liberal you are in terms of your inclusivity, whether you're referring to these things as Namsploitation or Ramboisploitation, many of the so-called Rambos, these phrases are utterly ridiculous, but many of the so-called Ramboisploitation films weren't necessarily dealing with Vietnam, but they were very obviously responding to the success of Rambo as and the the cultural ubiquity of Rambo. So if you're being liberal in that way, in terms of inclusivity, I reckon you could say there are somewhere in the region of, you know, probably more than 100, 150 films. And of course, we're talking about something that wasn't just an American phenomenon. It was a global phenomenon. So there were many American examples. Canon, who I mentioned earlier, they made several Vietnam War themed films. Several examples came out of Italy. There was also several films came out of the Philippines. Okay. So yeah, we're talking, you know, we're talking many, many dozens running into that, you know, 100 or so films, which in some way or another are dealing with this whole, you know, this whole sub generic set of ideas and themes in one way or another. Now, as far as more recent developments are concerned, yeah, that, I mean, there have been one or two pockets. I think the cycle itself in its, you know, in its densest form, more or less peters out by the end of the 1980s. There were one or two other films in the early 90s which come about. But if I was to, you know, if I point you in the direction of some more recent examples, I think Uwe Boll made a Vietnam War film. I think it was called Tunnel Rats, which I had sitting apart, and I still haven't looked at myself. I haven't brought myself to watch it yet. But there have been other kind of more mainstream, moneyed examples of Vietnam War films in recent years. The Last Full Measure, for example, which came out just a few years ago, which really didn't do any business. I found it lying around, you know, secondhand on DVD somewhere, but not many people saw it. It's very much a kind of a traditional patriotic gung-ho military rescue movie. Okay. And it was just pointed out to me the other day by somebody on Facebook that there is a new film coming out, I think in just a few weeks, called Ambush, which again looks to be some kind of conventional Vietnam War combat movie. Okay. So, yeah, there are still pockets in terms of films being made. But I think when we do see Vietnam being portrayed in films these days, it tends to be kind of marginal. I mean, there's a really interesting sequence. I don't even remember it in the, and it comes out of the graphic novel. There's that interesting sequence in Watchmen where Dr. Manhattan changes the course of history just by turning up in Vietnam. And that's part of what sets that whole alternative history in motion. He was just able to basically force the communist foe to surrender. I thought that was really well executed. I mean, I wouldn't call myself a great Zack Snyder acolyte, but I think he did some really good things in that film, and I thought his realization of that sequence was really interesting and well done. Yeah. So when and of course another example of Vietnam, the way in which it's kind of the way in which the trauma of Vietnam on film has kind of dissipated, I suppose, is best exemplified by the sequence and the whole narrative development of Tropic Thunder, where, you know, basically we can now have big budget Hollywood comedies which deal with this idea of Vietnam trauma and all of the conventions which have somehow become attached to the Vietnam War, or at least the Vietnam War inspired action adventure war film.
Neil, that's brilliant. Thanks very much for agreeing to do this. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Well, as you know, I could talk about this stuff for another hour, but I appreciate, you know, you're on a clock, like the rest of us.
Thanks, Neil.
That was Neil Jackson, and his book, Combat Shocks, is currently being written and will eventually be published by Bloomsbury. Thanks again to Neil, and thanks to you for listening. Newton Talks will return.